Something about our guy Nick Cage that just really gets the juices flowing, the creativity flowing. Luckily, it's, you know, those juices flowing never caused me to piss blood.
Blood.
Oh my God! We were just talking about Mandy before we hit record. Mm-hmm. There's just a line of delivery in each one of his movies that you're just like. Only him. It didn't really make sense for him to do it necessarily. It's like a trademark. It's like a little stamp.
Sure. It's I think that he put so much into like weird little idiosyncrasies in his voice. And like you hear it in Vampire's Kiss when he does that weird cry, and you know, if you're like us and you know, obviously listening to the director comms and everything. He's trying to say boo-hoo while he cries, but get away with it. Like, he's sitting there going like, boo-hoo! Boo-hoo! Like, and it's just only an actor like that would try something so insane. And I gotta think that, like, You Ripped My Shirt and Pissed Blood are probably some of his, like, little, just weird little idiosyncratic stuff that only a dude like him can do.
Yeah, it's a guy that's just going to bring something. And you're not going to know what that something is until he gives it to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's magical.
Indeed.
Yeah, oh, man. But, you know, enough about Nick Cage. Just kidding. Folks, we're back. We had our fun little spooky season. That was a very good time. But Denny and I were kind of racking our brains trying to come up with a new theme because we were only kind of planning on spooky season. You know, we did like a revisited theme each week and everything. So we were just like too caught up with those ideas. We forgot to make any new ideas. And somehow it's the way we operate, Denny, you and I, is just building off of each other in like random conversation where I'll ask you a question, pose an idea, you come up with a better idea, and that gives me an even better idea. And I was tossing around the idea. We were going to do a one-off episode, but this actually turned into a whole-ass theme, fortunately for everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the sweatiest title in all of our podcast history. Movies for Spin, You Steal the Deck Wheeleration of Spin Dependence. It's a mouthful.
You're gonna have to type the episode titles on this one. I mean, you usually do, but also on this one.
Yeah, I spell checked myself multiple times on it when I put it in the notes, so I'll post that in later. But yeah, if you can't figure out what that means by the very obvious title, we basically picked a bunch of worthwhile Nick Cage movies that we haven't covered yet. I put them on a randomizer wheel, hit go three times, and whatever movie popped up, that's what we got. And I kind of, we'll go through the movies now, but I kind of put them in and I was like, okay, like I'm gonna spin it three times, but if it's one that I don't really want to do, we'll just pretend it didn't happen. Didn't have to pretend, folks. These are the genuine 1, 2, 3 spins. I'm so fucking excited. First movie that landed on the pointy thing that went tick 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 landed here. Movie number one we're going to cover tonight, it is Matchstick Men. That's where it landed first, which was kind of a, you suggested we put it on the wheel. You suggested a bunch of movies and then you're like, oh yeah, also Matchstick Men. I was like,
right,
great idea. Movie number two, his only collaboration with Martin Scorsese, of course, it is Bringing Out the Dead. Hell yeah.
Which one of the few I hadn't seen.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot of people know about it, despite its weird intersection of these two talents. legends
not,
in the field.
Not just those two talents, but actually a lot of other very interesting talents. We'll get to that.
More on that next time. And lastly, but certainly not leastly, the inspiration for the title. The inspiration for many of us who watched this movie when it came out when we were in the 11 to 13-year-old range. National Treasure. The wheel spoke, and I fucking listened.
How could you not? It would be a sin. When the wheel is so clear in its voice, to deny it our ears, what kind of host would we be, Greg?
I think we'd be frauds, honestly. Yeah, I stuck a little ship-shaped ivory pipe into the middle of the wheel, and it spun to National Treasure, and I couldn't be more excited. More on that much later. But, of course, I was really hoping it would land on National Treasure when I was doing this alone at my computer. I popped gigantic when it landed on National Treasure to close it out. I was like, I don't need to spin anymore. I'm good. We got the three.
I couldn't believe it.
I damn near couldn't believe it either. I was like, damn, I was prepared to lie about this.
You had screenshots to prove it, though.
There you go. That's right. And Denny posted them, folks.
I did.
So if you didn't know what was coming, follow us on Instagram. That's all I'm going to say.
At Movies for When.
Yeah. It's the best thing about us is our Instagram account.
I would say it's our affable chemistry.
Ooh, I like that. It's the perfect companion piece to the podcast.
Sure.
So, I like that. But before we get into Matchstick Men, directed by Ridley Scott, speaking of legendary directors working with Cage, and then I don't think working with him again? I don't know. Before we get into Matchstick Men, Denny, we haven't spoken since right before Halloween, so tell me what you've been watching. I imagine there's some spooky movies in the mix there.
Well, there are, but that's also just partially because of who I am. Well, Greg, why don't I start with my Halloween night? Now, this typically, Vanessa and I really like to encourage trick-or-treating. We like to be part of keeping it alive, because boy, is it dying. especially with like the advent of stuff like trunk or treat, you know, like it's not that the tradition's necessarily dying out altogether, but there's fewer and fewer kids going door to door every year. However, this year, because our house is on the market, if you're finding that out from a podcast, I'm sorry, I'm not a better friend and or family member. Because our house is on the market, this year we didn't have costumes. We don't have any decorations up, and we don't have the money to go full bars, which, you know, I don't want to say it's something we're known for in the neighborhood, but I try to contribute in those ways.
To be known for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we pivoted, and we went on Halloween night to see Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein in theaters.
Very nice.
Which what was so cool about that, and it's because this is predominantly a Netflix release that had a really limited theatrical release.
It was like a week and a half or something, right? 2 weeks?
I think so. It might even still be playing at the Denton Alamo at the time of this recording. I'm not positive. But it really didn't go to a lot of theaters, so I was really, really fortunate to get to see it, first of all. Second of all, typically when like a big horror movie comes out for the fall, they want to release it in like September, so people are talking about it by Halloween. And also, Halloween night is not like Christmas and Thanksgiving in the sense that whole families go to movies together. Like, there's a lot of competition for entertainment on Halloween night, especially when it's a Friday night, like it was this year. Mm-hmm. And I was just delighted that the fates lined up that I would get to see something like this in theaters on my favorite holiday with my favorite person. It was just a really great night. As far as the movie goes, I can't recommend it enough. It is currently my number 4 movie for the year. If you have any doubt in your mind that Guillermo del Toro was meant to tell the story of Frankenstein, I want you to just pull up a tab right now on Google Images and search Guillermo del Toro's home. And you will see abundantly clearly that, like, he was born for this. It's definitely a movie that more focuses on the book's perspective with a lot of love for the Universal franchise. There's like an earlier necro experiment that basically just looks like Karloff in the Frankenstein getup. Mia Goth plays some homage to Bride of Frankenstein and attire here and there at appropriate moments. And so it's really got a little bit of everything for like how probably most Americans think of the imagery of Frankenstein, but also really incorporating the love of that imagery into Mary Shelley's novel. And dude, it just straight up fucks. Like, it's like a fucking fantastically great movie. I was absolutely in love with it. I feel very fortunate to have seen it on the big screen, because it is definitely something that belongs on the big screen. Something that is jarring to see on the big screen is the start of the Netflix logo that goes, or like the little Netflix lead in. We were like, Jesus Christ, it like scared us. It was like a jump scare.
Am I actually?
But one of the coolest things as a longtime Spooky Del Toro fan is that for a long time in the late 2000s, early 2010s, I want to say, he talked about doing a movie based on Disney's Haunted Mansion set in the 1800s, focused on the Hatbox Ghost, which would have been a really fucking cool Haunted Mansion movie for those who are fans of the ride and its lore. Yeah, if you saw the Danny DeVito Haunted Mansion that came out in 2023, it cured me of my Disney adultness. My condition was remedied because I realized, wow, never, ever, ever. Wow, they're never going to make anything good. I'm done. however, I really do, I've got to think that one, as a fan, this Frankenstein movie was the closest we were going to come to like an 1800s Guillermo del Toro ghost story type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's taking too much liberties to say he probably shared some similar points of inspiration here and there. So anyway, from this dude with two Frankenstein tattoos, I gave it a 47 out of 50. I gave the original a 48, so that should speak to how strongly it is a really, really great movie.
Well, hot damn. High praises.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard a lot of good things, especially just the production design of everything. So I'm excited to check it out at some point.
Yeah, and you know, it really makes me excited for what I'm calling Prestige Monsters Redux. Basically, in the 90s, with Bram Stoker's Dracula being a really big deal, they tried prestige monsters. There's a Mary Shelley's Frankenstein where Robert De Niro plays Frankenstein, and I really want to see it. There's also a Jack Nicholson werewolf movie called Wolf. And I think that was not something the world was really interested in the 90s. But I think that, like, with Nosferatu and Frankenstein being what they are, it really encourages me that we might finally be like in a place to culturally receive Prestige Monsters Redux. I'm ready for it.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone being more excited about this notion than you.
Yeah! Maybe Dairyberry.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well, that's two people.
We both have a lot to look forward to.
Two guaranteed ticket sales. Studios, listen up. Maybe multiple. What else you got?
So the next movie I saw was Begonia, Yorgos Lanthimos. How do you say the last name?
Yeah, I think you got it.
Cool. Begonia. I really liked it a lot. It's Jesse Plemons and Emma Stone. What I didn't know, which I know now, is that it is based on a Korean movie called Save the Green Planet that came out in, I believe, 2003. And Greg, I really, really want to see it. And it seems to be fucking impossible in the United States right now, at least with the resources at my immediate disposal. This motherfucking thing is hard to track down and watch. I'd really love to see it, because Begonia is a really interesting movie, and it's one of those that I can't talk much without spoiling it, so I won't.
Appreciate it.
But I would really love, because this is what's interesting, is I thought some other movies in similar genres had kind of touched on similar beats, and I was like, that's really not like a Yorgos thing to do. But if they're all influenced by Save the Green Planet, that is completely different. Anyway, I would love to see it. I would say, in terms of Yorgos, this is way better than The Lobster, significantly better than Kinds of Kindness. Not as good as Poor Things, but I really liked it. It's a good one.
Hell yeah. As good as you also watched Killing of the Sacred Deer last episode.
Killing of the Sacred Deer is better than this.
Okay.
But this would be number three that I've seen at least. So it'd be Poor Things, Killing of a Sacred Deer, and then Begonia is how I would rank it.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm really excited to check it out. I appreciate the lack of spoilers
here. Oh, dude, yeah. Anyone who, if you haven't seen anything yet, please don't. Just go see it. It's like, it's also probably his most accessible one I've ever seen. So that's a win for everyone. Just go in cold. That's great. I went to see Little Amelie, or The Character of Rain, which is a French animated film. And I was delighted to see that before it, there was a short film called Eru, E with the little accent mark, I-R-U. I believe it was an Irish film. Both of these movies, the short film and Little Amelie, are two of the best movies of the year. They're just fucking fantastic. For perspective, my Frankenstein review that I just gushed over is my fourth movie of the year, fourth favorite. Little Amelie, or The Character of Rain, is my third. It beats Frankenstein. Wow. It is just so fucking good. It is strikingly beautiful in its animation. And it is the most powerful story a neurodivergent child or parent of a neurodivergent child could hear at a time like this. Like, I can't say enough wonderful things about this movie. I got to see it at Alamo too, on the big screen and everything. And the short film that preceded it was of tippy top notch as well. Huge, huge fan. I've been enlightened in some really cool ways. Clearly moved by some movies that have come out this year. We often, make jokes about us being a current events podcast, because we're a pretty nostalgia heavy podcast. Let's be honest, we're pretty nostalgia heavy people. We're both actively building little hideaways that only have analog media in them, and we're proud of it. We would never change it. But I'm really excited to have seen, even in this little segment of stuff I'm talking about, three just really strong 2025 movies that everyone should check out. You don't need to be a freaking weirdo like me to like this shit. Like, these are just moving and powerful and artistic successes that I'm really happy are finding audience. I'm really happy they've reached me, and I hope they reach other people as well.
Hell yeah. I feel like the last 3 or 4 years, we've just been like, damn, you know what? This was a really good year for movies. Mm-hmm, and I'm happy to hear that the trend is continuing, and I would wholeheartedly agree. I've seen 35 of this year's
hot damn
movies, and a lot of them were stinkers, but the top ones are very, very good.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Ones that I will hold on to for a long time.
To get back in our usual nature and talk about, I didn't even realize this, but 3 days in a row I went 1999, 2000, 2001. Vanessa's been showing me some fun, like, chick flicks I've missed out on, or just, I don't know, not even chick flicks, but just, you know, type of stuff that I haven't seen a lot of. We watched 10 Things I Hate About You, which I had seen, but I hadn't really seen. I saw it on, like, a bus, a theater trip or something. Guys, 10 Things I Hate About You is fucking awesome, okay? It exists in this really cool, sarcastic unreality, that is very rated R and very actually hilarious. I think a lot of movies like this get kind of like bubblegummy bullshitty in their tone, and I think this gets lumped in with them sometimes because it came out around the same time a lot of those movies did. But like, man, this is just a blast. It's something that really stands the test of time. I think unfortunately it just kind of lightning rounds its third act, which I was going to give it, like, above 4 stars until they just kind of zoomed through the end there.
Checking the boxes on the to-do list of how to finish a movie kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, more so, I thought the characters got over very serious pain that I really believed in. They got over it pretty quickly because it was about time to wrap things up, is kind of what it felt like.
Oh, okay.
I just could have used a little more time to breathe, I guess, is really more what I'm saying, to really, like, let us sit in the emotion so we can like bask in the healing a little bit more. But all that goes to say, I think I gave it a 39 out of 50, which was a lot higher than I thought I was going to give it. It was really strong.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Very nice.
Moving on to 2000, we watched Bring It On. This is where a lot of quotability came from, like cheerocracy and cheer-tatorship and shit like that. I don't know if you grew up hearing that all the time, but I did. Man, in the 2000s, like, quotability was probably better than a big box office for a lot of comedies, you know? Like, before memes, children, we used to just shout movie quotes at each other to entertain ourselves. It's a very strange millennial phenomenon.
Yeah, we've covered Napoleon Dynamite here.
Yes, exactly. Lots of Will Ferrell quotes got yelled a lot,
oh,
too.
Oh, yeah.
This one it has a lot of really quotable moments. It has a really good story about white people stealing black people's art, which I really wasn't expecting that to be one of the like main focus of this movie, or for it to be done well and tastefully. I think a lot of movies like this, when they're like set on this big competition or something like that, or this big meet or whatever it is, they kind of lose their identity in it, because it's a comedy movie and it's really funny, but it's about people being like the best cheerleaders ever. So eventually they need to do some really good fucking routines, you know, like otherwise what's the movie? And I think while they do some like really fantastic routines in the finale, I feel like it's this movie that we don't really take much seriously in. And then it just kind of loses the comedy at a certain point. And, I don't know. It just has a little bit of an identity crisis, but I still liked it a lot. After that, we watched, to keep Julia Stiles in our lives, we watched Save the Last Dance. Greg, have you ever seen Save the Last Dance?
Sure haven't.
It's a pretty fun movie. Also, a lot about racial assimilation in there, and Julia Stiles said a few stupid things. But all that goes to say, I think I liked Save the Last Dance the least out of these three, but I had a fun time watching all three of them. And just to, let me double check and make sure this is true. Let's see. I think I watched the oldest movie I've ever watched is what I'm checking on. Let's see. Ooh. I did. Wait. I did, Greg. I watched the oldest movie I've ever watched. I watched 1923's The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Wow.
Yeah, dude.
Wow.
Starring Lon Chaney Sr. His son is the Wolfman, people.
Yeah, we watched Dr. Caligari. That's 20.
Oh, shit. Caligari is older. Okay, never mind.
And Haxan and Nosferatu. But oh, those just are those three.
Well,
just those three.
You know, I'm honestly glad you fact-checked me on that, because that's a little trivia point I would like to know about myself. Anyway, I watched the fourth oldest movie I've ever watched, Greg. Yeah. Edit this in. If you just had it do like fourth, like just like really like poorly done, that'd be funny.
Yeah, give me a good fourth. I'm going to use my own. That was a good
please
one.
Do.
We're good. We're
you set. Nailed it. You nailed it. Anyway, holy fuck, it's a good movie. I think I ended up giving it a 47, which is the same grade I gave not only the recently discussed Frankenstein, but also Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera. So this is like, it's a really cool horror movie, first of all. First and foremost, a horror movie. The scope of what they shot, for how like physically challenging the art of filmmaking was, literally the art of making the film, was a very challenging thing to do successfully. I cannot believe some of the shit they pulled off in 1923, dude. Oh my god. Guys, this is a movie that it's on YouTube for free. I watched it on YouTube. At the recommendation, a friend of the show, Chris Ramirez, who recently directed or opened the Addams Family show that he is producing. Everyone should go see it if you live in Chicago. That's probably Chris. That probably covers the audience in Chicago, but still. All that goes to say, gave me a great, great recommendation. It's such a like departure from what I'd been watching, but we were talking about it in the group chat, and I was like, you know what? If it's this good, I'm gonna check it out today. So that's been a long time monster movie I've been wishing to check off my list, and it is a very class conscious movie. It's a tale of intersectionality, of oppression, and the coolest way to take down nobility and experience tragedy while you do it.
Hell yeah. Oh, I just love when a 100-ish year old piece of media is like, wow, this speaks to me and is timeless.
102 nice. Years old at the time of this recording, right? Holy shit.
We love to hear it. All right, is that all the stuff you watched?
It is.
All right, I'll breeze through mine because most of it isn't really worth talking about.
I know something that is, though.
I might save that for next time.
Okay.
We know what we're talking about. But one thing that you don't know, Denny, I don't know how to make this transition work. I watched The Watchers from M. Night Shyamalan's other daughter, not the one that was in Trap, the other one. She directed a movie. It's called The Watchers. If you didn't see it, you might have actually seen it and just forgotten about it. It's not very good. I was expecting a lot worse because Will Reno's review of it was like scathing. It was very, it just called it very amateurish and like just blah. I didn't find it that bad. I found it insanely forgettable. It is like Ocean's 8 levels of passing through me. Mm-hmm. And coming out the other side and leaving nothing behind. Like, and I don't know, it's a nothing of a movie, and it committed the grand sin of refusing to end.
Ooh. Ooh.
Like, I'm already out. I'm ready to get out of here. It's like, you stand up out of your chair and someone's like, and that reminds me of, so you gotta sit back down. So that's what the ending felt like.
My personal hell.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of directorial debuts, I watch, oh shoot, Zoe Kravitz's directorial debut, Blink Twice, from this year. It was okay. It was pretty mid, I'm not gonna lie. It had some pretty fun performances, but you could tell it was a first effort, and that's fine. I think she's got a knack for parts of directing. Unfortunately, I think we need to restructure the sound department because this movie's sound choices were just awful. I am an ASMR hater, and I felt like this movie was made with me in mind negatively. So it was another one that just kind of came and went. It didn't really impact me very much. Next movie I watched, also from 2025, I watched Nick Offerman in Sovereign. It's on Hulu. If you haven't noticed, folks, I'm going in order of quality here. So I'm starting from the worst and I'm going to the best. So third worst, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, fourth best? I guess we'll see. Sovereign was okay. It felt like it had a lot that it wanted to say, but it wasn't really saying it. It's based on a true story, and it's an exploration of two very interesting people, a father and a son. It's just kind of a very drab exploration of their lives. It's basically Nick Offerman is a dad who's very much I am the only one that has authority over me, like the law doesn't apply to me, I know my rights. And he's just kind of like thinks he's above the law because he's, you know, just because, and is influencing his son, kind of going around and around the country and kind of preaching this sort of message to people, telling them to be like a sovereign citizen, that they are in control and ownership of everything is theirs, the government has no hand in what you do. And it winds up going very badly, as could be expected. If you've seen the poster, there you go. Gloomy, gloomy and grim, and not in a Greg movie way, unfortunately. In the middle of my list, which is right where it belongs, I watched Under the Silver Lake, finally.
Oh.
Yeah, it was okay. It was very engaging. It's a trippy LA noir. It felt like it left a lot to be desired. I think it was stylistically really, really cool. I liked Andrew Garfield's performance in it, but I don't feel like at any point I was rooting for his character. I think the movie was kind of just toying with him anyways, but like, it's a movie that's like, I don't know. I wasn't real, like, it felt like there's just so many mysteries, like what's behind the door and like what's really going on here, who's really in charge, where is this person. Feels like we're just following a bunch of running into a bunch of dead ends, basically. And I was like, at a certain point, I kind of felt like I didn't really think that the Garfield character deserved an answer for what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like this guy doesn't really, I don't know. I don't know how to explain that any better. I didn't feel like he deserved an answer, so I wound up not really, like, pining for an answer myself in the audience. He was just kind of a scummy dude that, like, I don't know. It was a little shitty. It left a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth, but overall I think it was a really cool movie. I'm glad I finally watched it. Stylistically cool. Just maybe a little empty for me in the end, despite how much was going on. All right. Speaking of directorial debuts, Denny, like we were earlier, I'm ringing the bell, ding, ding, ding. And the sign over the bell says, sleeper hit alert.
Sleeper hit alert. Oh, shit.
I'm sounding the alarm. Everyone, boot up Paramount Plus and go look for The Last Stop in Yuma County.
Ooh.
It is written, directed, and edited by Francis Galluppi, who I have never heard of until this movie. I was like, it's a low-budget film about a gas station in Yuma County, of course, Arizona, that has a cafe, and the gas station is out of gas, and we're just waiting on the gas truck.
Cool.
And people start showing up, one car at a time, waiting in the cafe for the gas truck to arrive. And, oh man, it's just great. It's just this great layering of, it's like very precise build and release and reapplication of tension. Like, there's so many different pressure points that just keep getting, like, added onto. The characters just keep entering the movie and, like, completely changing the dynamic of what's going on, but it all just flows together really, really well. With how complex it is and kind of how quickly it's, like, moving along and changing things and adding new layers and new wrinkles to the story, it's super easy to follow. It all just works really, really well. It's got some recognizable faces in it, and you can kind of tell it's a little more on the low budget side, but it's not to the movie's detriment in any way. I think this one is a super solid movie. I gave it a 33 out of 40. I had a ton of fun with it. I would watch it again. I think it it earns my top movie spot on this week's What
Nice.
We've Been Watching list.
Nice.
Also, a little treat for Greg. We saw Gene Jones, who was the gas station attendant in No Country for Old Men, and his wife was Robin Bartlett, who was Mrs. Gorfine from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, so, shit. Okay.
Couple small-time Coen Brothers actors entered the fold, and I was pleased to see them. Okay. All right. I saved the best for last, Denny. And it's a TV show that is on the streaming service that I swear exists as a joke, Apple TV Plus. I don't understand. Every show that comes on that platform feels fake. It's so weird. I don't get it.
One time there was one based on a commercial. And it
Which one was that?
Ted Lasso is based on a fucking commercial.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
I made it through 20 minutes of the pilot and turned it off. I did not like that show at all.
I actually fucking loved the first season. But it's also...
A lot of people did.
It was like... It made me cry and think about things in life at certain points. And then maybe even season two did. Three was a nosedive. All that goes to say, based off a goddamn fucking commercial, Greg, that does sound like a made-up show. I gotta agree with your point.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know... The obvious joke of this being a Jack Donaghy and 30 Rock idea. Idea for a new TV show. You take the guy from this commercial, put him in charge of a soccer team. Or whatever the fuck.
That's exactly what it was.
but a real show that actually exists and is created by good people is a show called Pluribus. Have you heard about this, Denny?
It's actually ringing a bell, but I don't remember why, so go ahead.
The creator of this show, you, the audience, may know Vince Gilligan as the guy that was a writer for The X-Files for a while, but he's the man that created Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And Denny knows Vince Gilligan as the person that was convinced by his wife in that episode of Community to quit Apple Computers and start doing VHS.
That is, okay, yeah. I felt like he was a guy from a thing I hadn't seen.
But he's now a guy from a thing you have seen. Wow. His new show, Pluribus, starring Ray Seahorn from Better Call Saul and not much else, she's fantastic in it. The show is so fucking insanely good. It's moody as hell. It's my ideal sci-fi that doesn't take place in space. It takes place in Albuquerque, not space. But like, this is like some just A-plus fucking sci-fi. You can tell that there's like a million directions it could go. It's only three episodes are out right now. It's just so sick. It's so well made, so well acted, so well executed, and so like well realized in the story. I can't wait to see where it goes. I think it's going to be something that a lot of people talk about for a long time. So, brief plot of it, I guess, is there's like an alien virus that infects everyone on Earth except for maybe like 20 or so people all over the world, including Ray Seahorn, who's in Albuquerque, and basically the alien virus makes every human being on Earth link minds, and they are all one collective mind. And they are just like, oh, you gotta watch it. You just gotta see it. You have to see
That's it. That's my shit. Let's do this. I'm sold.
I won't go any further. Not scary yet, but it is eerie. It's very, very cool. With all that out of the way, while Apple TV Plus may feel like a scam, it does actually deliver here. And if you have ever felt conned by Apple TV, don't bump into Nicolas Cage in Matchstick Men. Apple TV was invented by Nicolas Cage's character in Matchstick Men. Somehow. I'm going to connect these dots somehow. Yeah, Matchstick Men, folks, it's a 2003 film that you can rent in most places, or if you don't mind ads or have an ad blocker, it's on Tubi, so it's a few places, it's just, you know, not readily free. And like I said earlier, directed by Ridley Scott, who I think this is the only time he worked with Cage. Yeah, Ridley Scott.
No, I know that, it's just a, like... Okay, you know, like when you realize that he's the director of Matchstick Men, it's wild.
Yeah, he's done. If he hadn't also done so many like other kind of wild, like when you think of Ridley Scott, you think Gladiator, Alien, shit like that. Mm-hmm. You don't always think something like Matchstick Men, kind of an upbeat, I don't know, grounded, mm-hmm. also on Earth. and one thing you also, before we get into the review and everything, I want to mention it since we're here. A name you also wouldn't think you would associate with this movie, the score by Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
That name popped up in the credits and I said, what the fuck's going on here?
EP'd by Bob Zemeckis. What the fuck?
Really?
Yeah. What? How much, like, this is a fucked up group of people working on a movie, Greg. It's a fucking Mad Libs of 90s Hollywood in this bitch.
That is the perfect summation of the names in this associated with this. This is Mad Libs, the movie.
Yeah.
And then...
Mad Libs, man.
Nicolas Cage is a con artist.
Yeah. Don't say that about him. I think he deserves a lot of the work he gets.
Boo. He deserved Primal. Okay, before we go any further, Critiker Review of the Week. This user gave it a 7 out of 10 and really outlines my feelings about this movie. They said, pretty good, but not quite great. Cage is strong, as is Loman, but the Rockwell character didn't add a ton for me. I kind of saw the ending coming, and while most films that end with this kind of idea require some suspension of disbelief at the sheer number of coincidences it would take, this one goes even further than most. The relationship with Cage and Loman is really well done, and they had great screen chemistry. I agree with all that. I like that. That was kind of my takeaway, too. I'll summarize the plot for you guys real quick. Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell are con artists. They basically swindle people out of money one way or another. It's got like a their current scam when we get introduced to them is bank fraud, basically. Like they trick older people into signing over access to their bank account. They withdraw all the cash and see you later. It is revealed to Nicolas Cage that his ex-wife secretly was pregnant and had a daughter. It's his daughter that he hasn't met, and she is 16? 12? 16? 16. 16 years old, I think. And yeah, they reconnect. She starts staying with Nick Cage a little bit more, and their relationship kind of grows. And they try to plan one last big heist, one last big scam? Con? One last con before we go off right off into the sunset, but things start going awry. Who's really in control? And I forgot to mention Nicolas Cage as a man with a bunch of different phobias and tics in what I can only use as a lead into my first question, Denny, is what is this character's issue? What are the issues with this character? What is going on? It can't just be phobias. Explain to me what's happening here the best you can.
He has a obsessive compulsive disorder proper.
I picked up some of that. I have close personal I have a relative with, again, real OCD. Mm-hmm. You know, not just like, you know, but like real actual OCD. I recognize some of that, but there were like additional tics and that kind of thing. There was like other kind of weird phobia reactions too. It wasn't just OCD. It felt like there was a lot of other stuff going on, and maybe that's just Cage bringing a whole bunch of extra stuff to the role. I'm not really sure.
What are you like the like 1-2-3 type of stuff?
The 1-2-3 type of stuff. Yeah, my relative. They'll every time they use the sink, they will in the kitchen sink. There's like a process of turn it on, you know, use it, and then turn it off, back on, rotate this, rotate yep. that, touch the water to your mouth, turn it off, rotate one more time, up and down, and then done with the sink. Wash your hands on the same towel. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's a coin collection where coins are stacked certain amounts, certain ways on, like, different desks in the house. That's my relationship with what I've seen in OCD, and a lot of the same things were kind of presented here. But not just a clean house, I guess I would say.
No, yeah. I mean, like, and obviously this is, like, sexed up for a movie, you know? Like, but I also think that, like, if you ask me, like, why would Ridley Scott be interested in making a movie like this? To me, it's all in the, like, portrayal of the mental illness here. That's where I really see both Cage and Scott's talents really shining, is in the scenes really focused on that. I think, like, to give a breakdown of, like, kind of the function of OCD in a person's brain, like Greg was saying, it's not just really liking a neat workspace or whatever it is, you know, like, but it's more that a person has certain things that they will obsess over. For example, they may obsess over whether they left the stove on, and then they will have a compulsion checking the stove. For example, a checking compulsion is a type of compulsion, or sometimes it can be a compulsion to confess wrongdoing or something like that. But basically, it's meant to alleviate this mental and emotional state of distress by doing like one of the very specific rituals you just described. It's all like on some level it can be rooted in the belief that like something bad will happen if you don't do these things, like a loved one will die. Some people experience it like that. Other people, you can also experience it just as like a bad emotional experience that will not go away unless you do this thing. And I'm not a specialist in OCD. I don't know as much about it as I do some other mental illnesses. I know that it's a motherfucker. I can tell you that mm-hmm. much. And I can tell you that, it is a lot of cognitive and emotional work to pursue healing from that. And, but what I meant to say is that a really common thing in OCD is feeling like you have to do things three times. Or like a certain number of times. And, I wasn't even picking up on it at first. I just, one of my first notes is that Nick Cage is counting to three in every language, like he wants to be a world traveled wrestling referee.
I would watch that movie.
But yeah, it's just really common to feel like you have to go like one, two, three when you open the door, like open it and close mm-hmm. it three times before you can walk out. And I think like, I don't know that I see tics with OCD. Again, I'm not an expert. I don't know that I see the kind of tics with OCD that are displayed in this movie, at least not commonly. He kind of has, and I'm even less of a knowledgeable source on this, but he kind of reminds me of some examples of Tourette's syndrome I've seen. Where, and it's also like what a lot of people don't understand about Tourette's is that like, it's not necessarily just like screaming inappropriate things, but a lot of it is just uncontrollable noise making or just like psychomotor or verbal tics. And so that kind of reminded me, at least as far as I'm aware of, kind of like a real world portrayal of OCD and a real world portrayal of maybe something like Tourette's, but then you sex them both up a little cause it's a Ridley Scott movie. And then there's this whole, you know, the mind fuck, or at least the attempted mind fuck of the plot. I kind of agree with the critical review of the week on that aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not super hard to clock that something was up. What I was thinking of you when it clicked in my head that something was up. What was there a moment that made you realize like, okay, I'm starting to look for what's really going on here kind of thing. Like not everything's as straightforward as it's seeming kind of thing.
So I was this is where I was confused on it is I have seen this movie before. I didn't remember it that well. But I watched it several years ago and I definitely got drunk while I was watching it. Cause I remember how stressed I was the day I bought it at Movie Trading Co. I didn't remember exactly what happened, but I definitely knew there was some Christopher Nolan-ry afoot.
Multiple timelines.
Yeah, yeah. So I forgot a lot of the specifics of it, probably because I was getting drunker near the end of the movie. But I definitely... I had that sense of unease. And I also had this sense that it didn't really blow my mind when they pulled the trigger. And I think that I know my first watch, I came away liking it a whole lot less than most people do. This time I was like, this is pretty fun. It's a fun little movie.
Yeah, it's a fun one. Just because something is obvious doesn't mean like the movie sucks, basically, unless that's not a blanket statement. That's not, you know, it can be too obvious and ruin the movie. But yeah, in this case, it was whatever. For me, it was the when he gets the new therapist and, you know, he's like showing drug-seeking behavior by means of yelling for drugs.
It's the subtleties of the profession that Ridley Scott really covers.
Yeah, that's why you bring the big guns, Nick Cage, to portray someone like this.
Excuse me. You made me laugh so hard, I pissed blood.
Oh my god, more on that later. It was that, and then the therapist, like, just giving him drugs, and I was like, okay, he's either a shitty therapist and something's up, or it's a placebo and something else is up. And I wound up being doubly right, as it turns out. But it kind of made me start looking at the movie as like, okay, let's stop believing everything we're seeing. And then I was like, that got me thinking about the daughter. I was like, we haven't even seen or spoken to the ex-wife this whole time. Is she really related to him? And then I was like, I was more just trying to figure out, like, I was enjoying the watch, of course, because there's like a fun sort of con going on, but like I was kind of also watching it with the mindset of like, who's really pulling the strings here kind of thing. So I was looking at it through that lens, unfortunately. But I don't, if you're over the age of like 17, I don't know how you don't like start picking up on these kind of things. If you've seen movies, you can kind of feel something's coming.
And that's the weird spot, isn't it? Where it's like, you need to, like, especially for the, like, mindfuck that this movie pulls, it needs to feel very earned, but also completely unpredictable. And, like, I think this movie, first of all, explains the grandiosity of it, like, the whole, like, fake medical facility and shit like that. I think it explains it a lot less than it could. It's not an unsatisfactory explanation, but I think it explains it a lot less than it could. I also think the movie is trying to do a whole lot, and it doesn't necessarily have the infrastructure to do all of that. It's basically three characters, you know? Like, And so I think it's so weird. It's so weird when we've seen this very small world between these, like, three key characters, essentially. And then you have, like, fake... The whole team... the world starts to feel very big in the end of the movie. And I think that is just... it just is a very different feel than we've had. And it just feels a little disjointed, I think, is all.
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense. It's like, all of a sudden, this goes all the way to the top.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. And, like...
top of what? Was there a thing that we knew that there was a top of?
Right.
Just thought it was these two guys. And like, it kind of was, but really it's just like, it felt so small scale that having like, seeing the big picture is like, okay, the picture's a little too big, if I'm being honest.
It felt like
the core of the connection of the movie is the relationship with Cage and his daughter. And like the review said, like this was really well done. I liked their relationship. I thought they performed well off of each other in their scenes together. But yeah, I was more drawn to those kind of smaller intimate moments, like her first little con with a lottery ticket, that kind of thing. That's like as big as the movie needed to feel.
Yes.
Yes. It was succeeding most in those smaller moments.
I really, really agree with that. Like, the laundromat was the perfect example of just, like, this is how big I want the world to be. Well, and because even so, it's like... And I understand. Like, they established that Nick Cage's character is a millionaire, you know, like, and not only would, you know, his so-called daughter... think that, but his partner would know that. You know, like, and I understand that. I don't think just so there's no ambiguity, if you haven't figured out the spoilers by now, Nick Cage's con man partner, Sam Rockwell, or wait, is it Sam Rockwell? Yeah, don't let him go on the moon by himself. That's the guy. Him and God, what's the name of the I'm
Lohman
drawing a blank.
Is her last name. Lohman.
Lindsay Lohman.
Lindsay Lohman.
I'm kidding. That's Lindsay Lohan.
No, it's not. Allison Lohman.
Allison Lohman.
Who was, I believe, 20 when she was filming this movie?
Yeah.
No, she would have been like 22, something like that.
Yeah.
23.
They basically take Nick Cage on this wild, delirious ride and steal all of his money that he has in a safe deposit box. And I get that, like, his partner basically had a unique opportunity to pull that crime. Like, I get that. But it's also, like, he said millions, not billions, guys. You know, like, like, I get the impression that this is a wealthy dude, and he also says he's been smart and put his money away, but, like, listen, guys, he lives in a nice house, don't get me wrong, but, like, it's not, like, fucking Great Gatsby when you walk in there.
Yeah. It, like, it has a pool.
Yeah.
It looks nice because it's so clean, but it's got two bedrooms?
Right.
And that's about it.
Don't get me wrong. I'd think it was super badass if I owned that house. Don't get me wrong. But, like, it just... Have you ever heard the term long walk for a short drink of water?
Yeah.
That's what it seems like the crime is. And don't get me wrong. Like, millions of dollars would change my life. But you would have had to spend a lot of money to make a lot of this shit happen. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Did you ever watch the David Fincher movie The Game?
I did not, no.
Okay, then I'll stop talking about it. But
did you ever watch The Wrestler, Triple H, The Game?
No.
Good, I'll stop talking about it. It's boring. Dude can't work.
All right. Well said. Glad we're in agreement. Okay, trying to go to my notes here and see if there's anything I really had. I can't decide where I want to go. Do I want to go to the very ending of the movie, or do I want to go to the cage stuff? Let's save the cage.
Okay.
We're kind of on the movie's intentions and the overall tone and feeling of the movie, especially with the story. The ending was about as subtle as a shovel over the head. What really makes you rich is having a family. That's what wealth truly is.
It felt so gross, too.
It felt really unearned, especially because I think that was the first time we saw the love interest woman anywhere besides behind the grocery store register.
Yeah.
It was really weird. I even thought to myself at a certain point through, like, are we really done with the grocery store clerk lady?
Mm-hmm.
She was in the movie. And then they're married and pregnant at the very end. And I'm like, okay, I guess, whatever. It was very underdeveloped, I would say. But it wasn't, like, overly explored at the end either. I don't think she had any lines in that closing scene.
No.
I think... Oh, man. I don't know. That didn't really quite work for me. What about for you?
I don't like the ending. and especially with the whole, the epilogue that Nick Cage and Alison Lohman have.
Mm-hmm.
I
thought that was all right.
Man, if they left the daddy talk out of it, I think I could have heard it more. I think it would have been easier, more palatable for me if they just kept the daddy discussion to a minimum in that whole fucking arc they did.
Oh my gosh. I think she just says dad, but I see what you're saying.
It's just... What a weird choice, Mr. Scott. What a weird choice.
Mm-hmm. I want to say this is based on a book, so we won't entirely blame.
Oh, wait, no, you are right. It is based on a book.
But...
That's a book-ass ending right there is what that is.
Let's take some creative liberties here in certain little areas.
Man, I don't know. I just... It's also... It's one... The attempted mindfuck... does not hit its full intended effect. Not to say it falls completely flat, but I think if you're gonna do that, you really need to fucking wow the audience. And when you don't, and then you just kind of have this whole, like, 20 years later ending. You know, it wasn't 20 years, but you know what I mean.
It was like one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just... I don't know. It felt... The scene was more about, like, forgiveness, because if you really like left that movie with Nicolas Cage like confronting zero of the people that conned him, especially the one that was most important to him, it would feel kind of like, and then they ran away and that was it.
Mm-mm.
That's pretty fucked up. That kind of sucks. So I'm glad there was like a little reunion, a little sign of respect, some forgiveness, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not a whole lot said, but a lot felt. It kind of worked for me. Maybe I agree with you about
daddy.
All right, calm down.
Listen, she's a 700-year-old demon in
no,
the...
No, 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 no. We're not doing this. But enough about Denny's search history.
Oh, don't put that on me. Oh, ugh. Absolutely
Let's go to the
not.
Star of the show, Denny. The main star.
Let's do it.
You know who I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, Sam Rockwell. Don't let him go to the moon.
Don't let him go to the moon by himself. Mm. Or if you do... I won't spoil Moon.
Never I was mind. About to say.
Settle down, Greg. Yeah. Nicolas Cage in this thing. The reason mm-hmm. we're all here. The mm-hmm. reason we spun the wheel of the deck wheel ration of spin dependence really rolls off the tongue. he's the reason we're here. He's one of the main reasons we have a podcast. How do you like the usage of him in this movie? How do you like his choices? How do you feel about this movie overall in the oeuvre of his whole prolific career? Is this a worthwhile addition to the Cage universe?
I'd put it probably on my C tier Cage, you know, given there's like an S, an A, and a B. I'd say this is probably C, which isn't necessarily an insult. Yeah. It's not prime Cage, I would say. I do
low end, yeah, low end B, high end C, mm-hmm. I think is where I would put it. For the movie itself, the Cage performance itself, I think, is kind of what brings the movie up mm-hmm. a little bit. Mm-hmm. What say you?
I would agree with you. And I think that, again, if you ask me, like, what is Ridley Scott interested in, I really think it's how is he going to use video and sound to convey the frantic internal experience of this character with OCD, is to me where I really feel like he's doing something really interesting in the story, something really interesting as a director. And I think Cage was a really, really great performer for the intended purposes of that. And I think that so like early 2000s Cage is one of the more bland Cage eras, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this movie is so bland that the whole thing is covered in boomer beige. Do you know what boomer beige is, Greg?
This is a new term to me, but please continue.
Well,
tell me.
So check it out. What color is your hoodie?
It is gray.
What color is my hat?
It appears gray.
Yeah.
Can't really tell on the camera. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this concept called millennial gray, or agreeable gray.
It's how we all decorate our homes. I get it.
Exactly. Now, the theory behind that is that it is because so many millennials were traumatized in the beige and white homes of the boomers. Our parents' generation's home. Mine was bright white everywhere. Also, the 2000s are very beige. They just are very beige, early 2000s. And so to me, this whole movie is boomer beige on digital photography, which is just really a very unpleasing visual. I think that there's a lot of things that fall flat in this movie. And I think Sam Rockwell's character is probably meant to come across as a lot cooler than he does. He's kind of, yeah. it's like they kind of wanted to do like Fight Club and The Sopranos, and they didn't do either as well. And yeah, we have our, you know, our bargain bin Tyler Durden and Sam Rockwell's character, and our bargain bin Tony Soprano and Nick Cage's character, this mobster with a mental health condition. Man, that really is a ripoff, isn't it? I guess he's not a mobster. He's a con artist with a mental health condition.
Yeah, of all the things to blend together.
It's
a weird one.
I really think that you get to see some of Cage's true, like, insanity come out in this movie in ways that aren't as common at the time. And I think that without Cage as a performer, as you said, elevating this, I think that it's just kind of like a hodgepodge of forgettable ideas. But then you put this one-of-a-kind performer at the center of it, and you match the role with him like this, and then you put the director like Ridley Scott, and you get a pharmacy scene that's going to be in a million Nick Cage compilations. If you go to YouTube right now and type in Nick Cage compilation, I guarantee you're going to get the pharmacy scene from this movie in every single one of them.
Yeah, and it's not just him making that scene either.
No, yeah.
It's definitely the direction. It's the quick editing that's taking place. It's really good. God damn. Yeah, I think he absolutely elevates this film to something, and it's just so weird. Like, and we talked about him and Loman being great together. Sam Rockwell in this movie, exactly what you're saying, just kind of an off-brand Tyler Durden, sort of. Feels like the movie thinks he's cooler than he is. I was a little disappointed with him and the character. I was like, I know he's better than this, man.
Yeah.
He comes off like too much of an asshole, if that makes sense.
Sure.
He's like, he's never sensitive to like the known OCD tics. He's like, all right, the fucking door three times again. Almost forgot. Like, come on, you guys are supposed to be friends here. And just like stuff like that. And like, clearly Cage is going through like a mental breakdown, and he just leaves him a bunch of messages and doesn't go and check on him until like the next day. It's I don't know. It just feel like he wasn't really, the character wasn't concerned very much with anything really going on in an effort to come off as more cool. And that didn't really work for me, especially when it's supposed to be kind of like a, I think that's why the turn doesn't really work. It's supposed to feel like more of a betrayal than it winds up feeling like, because I just don't buy their friendship all that much.
Well, and he's like supposed to be like the one big splash of color and personality that this really drab movie has. You know, even like something I was thinking about is like Nicolas Cage is a very colorful performer, but his like wardrobe is so fucking like any dad at an airport in 2003 looked exactly like him on a fucking business trip or whatever it is. But anyway, he's supposed to be our big splash of color, and he's just not that colorful. You know, like, it just, he doesn't pop like he's supposed to pop, and you can tell.
Yeah, it's like having a comic relief character that isn't funny, and I'm not saying that's what's going on here, but I think it is kind of the same sort of sentiment or feeling that we're kind of getting there. What a shame.
And I love Sam Rockwell, too, and
don't get us wrong.
I just don't know that he's the actor for this part, to be honest with you. Like, do you know who it should have been? No joke. And I promise you it would have been a better movie for it. Sean William Scott.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of like that.
And he was doing, Walking Tall around this time. Like, he was still getting some work. He was still off of the Stiffmeister run, you know? I think he would have been perfect for this movie.
Yeah, he's someone, like, kind of to my point, he's someone that, like, just has a little more love in his eyes.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. Like, he feels like a more compassionate person, which would make that, you know, ultimate betrayal feel a lot, like, have a lot more of an impact on the audience.
Absolutely.
In this case, us. But it just, I kind of like that. I was going to ask you, but I wasn't sure you would pull one out.
I didn't have that. That came to me just now, so it's chemistry.
I asked you with my mind, and you answered with your mouth.
As I always
appreciate
it.
Anyways. Do you have any other notes on the movie or anything?
Well,
my last thing is, I hate to nitpick, but there's some movie tropes that piss me off. And Nicolas Cage taking pills without water pisses me off. I don't like that.
I took one without water yesterday.
Oh man, ugh.
I usually need water.
Did you look cool as shit?
No, I just didn't have water near me. I went and got some in a little.
Much better. Yeah.
I'll on one more note from the movie. I would say that something that is really troubling about Nick Cage's miraculous hair regrowth that he has experienced late in life is that his hair no longer looks like a bird. And this is peak bird hair Cage.
No, it's not.
What's peak bird?
We covered Next on this show.
Fine.
Be serious, Danny.
Sorry, this was a This that next is so peak he's almost molting bird hair.
Yeah, we're ramping up there. He does this movie and then the next year is National Treasure and then a couple years later is next where he's full bird.
Man. I just always remind myself when I'm feeling insecure about my own hair loss, Nicolas Cage did not get where he is in life with a full head of hair. That's what I always try to remind myself.
There you go. We can't all be Neil Breen.
He's got a full head of something.
There's stuff up there. Not sure what's going on.
It's like just back hair. It's like really long back hair on his head. It's not head hair, it's back hair.
In that case, it's very well maintained.
Indeed.
Love him even more.
Indeed.
Yeah, we ready to do some gimmicks, or what are we thinking? This
feels
kind of like a short discussion on the movie, but
I did not have that much to say. To be honest with you, this was probably my least substantial of. Sorry for those at home. I watched ahead because I thought we were going to do all three at once. I didn't have as much to say about Matchstick Men. I think it's. Frankly, I don't know. I just don't think it's that interesting of a movie. It's good. I liked it. I'd watch it again, but it's just like, just at the end of the day, I wouldn't wait in line for it.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun, and you'll have a good time watching it, but you're not going to like go gab with your friends about what you liked about it kind of thing. But it's fun. Worth checking out.
For sure.
Okay, we are going to do the gimmick of the week, which is actually being resurrected. Early on in this podcast episode list, you'll find Movies for When You're Having a Good Old-Fashioned Cage Match. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the genesis of the podcast where Denny and I would get together, have a cage match, watch two Nicolas Cage movies, and decide which one was better. And we had a cage match on this podcast. And the gimmick of the week for that particular episode was the moment of unbearable weight. Because we did it the week before The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent came out, which is where we did our live show at the Alamo Drafthouse, where we watched that movie and then recorded our thoughts in front of an audience. And it was a lot of fun. So, the moment of Unbearable Weight, Denny, what do you got for Matchstick Men?
So, I basically had the entire experience of the character feigning for more meds. Because, one, I felt like the character was experiencing the unbearable weight of a need for relief. And I also felt like it was the time in the movie where Cage just couldn't hold the weight of his talent in any longer, and he started caging. And so, to me, that was like a good nexus of actor and performer having a moment of unbearable weight together. Oh, wait, no, really character and performer, not actor and performer.
Yeah. Who is the real Cage? There's a heavy temptation here to pick, you know, the iconic line we're talking about from the pharmacy. Have you ever been dragged out to the sidewalk and beaten until you piss blood?
Yeah.
I want to call that one out. It's not my winner, but I do want to call it out because the sheer inspiration to have your, like, have him have the tick and like kind of stutter do that, like have a little beat of separation between the main line and then piss blood is that's him. That's his trademark. Who else would think to do something like that? It's fantastic. But my moment of unbearable weight, Denny, something a little more subtle. During the formation of the relationship with the with his daughter, Nick Cage is confronted with her coming of ageness, and she's asking for things like cigarettes, beer, talking about things like sex. And every time he was confronted with something he is uncomfortable with, he goes, a noise that nobody on planet Earth would think to make in the scenes where he makes those noises. I fucking loved it. Outstanding. No
Legend.
One told him to do that.
Legend.
I don't think he even thought to do it. I think in the moment, he just knew what he had to do.
One
and he
true
got it
God.
Done.
One true One God.
Oh my god. Fantastic. All right, Denny, what's your favorite line for Matchstick Men?
Well, you already said it. Pissed blood. I'll save us the dance. There's just nothing better. This was one that it's just that's the line for me. If you ask me to say one thing about this movie, I would say pissed blood.
And it's hard to disagree. I guess I'll go with that one too. I had a nice little runner up here though. I like when we're learning about the lottery ticket scam. Cage says to his daughter, whatever you do, make sure the person you're conning isn't conning you.
Oh, that was the moment that I was like, oh, fuck off, when I was rewatching. I was like, you know, God why? Damn it, I remember that. Fuck it. That's what this movie does.
You want to know why you thought that?
Why?
Because I swear that they turned up the volume for that line within the conversation.
Okay, yeah. I'm so glad you talked about it, because that's actually, like, a major, like, negative on the movie that we actually didn't get into at all. I completely forgot about it, but like, dude, that was when you asked me the moment that I thought something was up, I should have just said that, because it was like,
yeah,
as though this movie could be about anything else after that line was said, as though it could be about anything else.
And again, it's like not much, but it's like 8% louder than the stuff he was saying before for some reason.
It's like when the TV goes to commercial and you're like, wait, they want my attention really bad right now. This is louder.
Oh my god. Just like, did you get that, audience? Just, oh, this is for the folks not paying attention. It's piss blood. It's fantastic.
Yep.
My favorite thing about that scene, though, aside from the tremendous line delivery, after his little freak out, he talks more with the pharmacist. He turns around and he apologizes to the guy that he said that to. He's kind of like, yeah, all right, thank you. He kind of runs off to go get the pillows, and he's like, oh, sorry. He apologizes to the guy. I really like that. I don't know.
Guys, I don't know if, like, I take a lot of meds. It's just a very relatable pharmacy scene, okay? Like, there's literally, I think of that scene all the time because CVS, where I get my meds, basically has a sign up that says, like, if you berate or threaten us, we won't give you your meds. I always think of that particular scene, and I'm like, dude, I guarantee they've seen worse. I guarantee, like, the average pharmacist is like, oh, the Matchstick Men scene? That's, like, a good day. You know? Mm-hmm. Like, the average pharmacist has seen so much worse than this, I'm sure.
Just walk up to your pharmacist and go, no, they'll get you what you want. It's like a secret code. It's like a secret menu, like In-N-Out. You just got to know to say the right things.
Secret menu at the pharmacy for those who have insurance.
Yeah. Wink twice and you'll get a Vicodin or whatever. Yeah. If you quote the whole scene, they give you painkillers. It's great.
They have to. They'll be too afraid not to.
That's right. They don't want to be dragged out to the sidewalk and beaten until they piss blood. So, all right, Denny, I guess the last question I got for you, what would you give this one as a critic score? How would you rate this?
I gave it a 36 out of 50, which is not really a bad grade at all. I feel like we kind of were trashing it a little bit, but
yeah,
that's a very okay grade for me. That's an okay movie. This definitely fits that criteria, probably on the better side of okay, to be honest with you, but also, yeah, there's lots of really, really, really good movies to watch. Why watch an okay one?
Yeah, that's right. I think I would still recommend this to somebody. Like, if maybe not, like, pull it out, like, hey, what should I watch? Like, oh, you should watch this. Mm-hmm. But if someone said, like, hey, I've been thinking about watching it, I would say, hey, it's pretty fun. If you're in the mood for it, go for it. It's a fun movie. I gave it a little bit above a passing grade. It does pass, so I gave it a 26 out of 40. So about a 6.5 out of 10. I do think it is fun, and there's so many things to enjoy about it. Chief of which is, of course, the Cage performance. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's nice. There's some nice moments too that don't fully depend on him doing his thing. Mm-hmm. So some really cool filmmaking stuff. Some really cool editing stuff. Yeah. Some really cool lighting choices too. I like mm-hmm. I like a lot of this stuff, like the harsh lighting when he's kind of like experiencing some kind of breakdown and that kind of thing. It all works. a lot of it works. Maybe a little too long. Not as cool as I think it is. Not as slick as she thinks.
Yeah.
Fun movie. Watch it, guys. Even though we spoiled it, but the movie kind of spoils itself. Denny, what are we doing? I'm going to spin the wheel here, and we're going to...
Greg and his notepad, the Foley art that has been done with that notepad over the course of this podcast.
We've landed on a movie, Denny. What is it? Even though we already said
that was really good. that was a really good spinning wheel.
What are you talking about? It was a deck wheel ration of spin dependence.
That's what I was talking about. What a good wheel it was. That literal wheel that we just heard.
That's right.
We're watching Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead. It's going to be fucking rad. It's going to be a good con. I have a lot more to say about that than this one, I will say.
I think I will too. And I'll get into why and all that shit later. But I need to watch the movie first. I haven't seen it in a little minute here, so...
Sweet
folks, that's your opportunity to go watch that movie. Yeah, if between the two, watch that one. Thanks for listening, but listen, watch that movie.
If you're gonna watch one movie from this theme, Bringing Out the Dead is the movie officially, unofficially, National Treasure is what you should.
No, everyone's already seen it.
That's so a good point. That's a good point.
People listening to this haven't seen National Treasure. Let's be real here.
That's a good point.
Yeah, if you're listening to this show and you haven't seen National Treasure, reach out. Tell us what you're doing wrong with your life. What else you're doing wrong with your life, I should say.
Other than listening to this show.
Whoa. Easy there. All right, Denny. I don't have to spin the wheel, of course. I know I'm going to land on the best of the best. I'm going to go ahead and ask you to spin me up the catch wheel phrase, please. a wheel good catchphrase.
For Greg, the not so secret Match Johnson, I'm Denny. Let's hope the placebos work, Taylor. And this has been Movies for When. We already told you spin, but you know what we didn't tell you? What's my cage again? Full circle on the wheel. The wheel spins full circle. This is why the song was written. This theme.
See my badge?